Hello and welcome to today's episode of Tranquil Awakenings with me, Debbie Eisen. On today's episode, I will be in conversation with John Armitage, a therapeutic practitioner who is trained in a number of therapies, including NLP and cranial sacral therapy. During this conversation, we will talk about the ways we learn, the stress response, and how we work as therapeutic practitioners. We hope you enjoy today's episode. Thank you ever so much for coming along today. So I haven't seen you for quite a lot of years, probably 2017, we think.
I think so.
And it was when
I was 6, 7 years, I guess.
Something. Yeah, it was just when I was doing my NLP practitioner training. So when I was fairly inexperienced in terms of my therapeutic career, I'd probably been a therapist for about 3 years at that time. And you came in to a couple of the sessions just to impart some of your wisdom and say hello, really. And it's always been my intention for us to catch up at some point, but then pandemic happened, life's happened. And before we know it, it's about 7 years later. So I thought it'd be great to have you on the podcast.
Wicked. And it's really funny that you say, though, that you were just a short way into your kind of career and you weren't necessarily the most confident or experienced practitioner at the time, because I didn't get that impression. I didn't know how long you had been in therapeutic work at that time. So
Oh, well, that's nice.
I didn't get that impression at all. I thought Debbie knows what she's talking about and what she's doing. Yes. Yeah.
Well, I think that did. In terms of like when I learn something new, I really go into it. I want to be like the very best version of myself that I can be. So I'll learn, I'll study, I'll experiment, I'll explore. And I just throw myself into any training.
Throw yourself in. That's the thing, you see, because there was that way that you just, I'm just doing this. We're here. We're doing this thing now. No, I'm present with this. Whatever happens. Yeah.
And that's something that drives Pete insane a little bit because he's very different to me. I'm very much big picture. I'll observe or watch a therapist doing something. I'm like, right, when's the next opportunity I can give that a go? When can I practice that? When can I explore it? Yeah. When can I tweak it and shift it so I can get it in a way that works for my client and for me? Whereas Pete's more that standoffish person that will observe and he'll need to practice it over and over again, really break it down. So we've got such different ways of working, but I think I always go in head first of, can I make this amazing?
Well, that's interesting that, because how do you acquire a new skill, a new therapeutic approach? I'd be fascinated to know maybe you've thought about this, maybe you have broken it down for yourself, but if you haven't broken it down, maybe we could do that now. You know, what's the process for Debbie going, oh, something's going on here. I can see this. I'm witnessing something. Uh-huh. This is inspiring me. This is grabbing me. I want to do that. What is it that you want to do? Because what are you taking away from that?
I think it's unlearning what we've been taught in schools. So I think if we go back to when we were very young and when we were children, if you think about children, the first 5 years of their lives, they emulate what's going on around them. They just get fully absorbed in the moment. They're not necessarily analysing or breaking down how does somebody do it. They use their senses and it's modelled to them. And actually, that's an incredible learning experience. So we learn how to walk. We learn how to talk. We learn how to copy tasks around the house just by being in the experience. Then we get to school and all of a sudden we're told to break it down into facts and figures and numbers and processes. And I think we almost lose that step of just being immersed in the experience. So I think what I've had to unlearn is the unhealthy habits of an educational system so that I can just be immersed. So if I observe or witness something taking place therapeutically, it's about using my senses to be fully in the present, to really notice, to see what's happening, to listen, to feel, and to pick up all those little things that maybe we wouldn't if we were trying to analyze or rationalize it.
Yeah.
So I think that's how I do it.
Okay. So being fully present, immersing oneself within that. Also being aware that in any experience and any, should stick with therapeutically beneficial experiences for the moment, there are going to be so many different dimensions.
Yeah.
In which something is taking place, something is happening. So as you say, you know, you'll see things, you'll hear things, you'll smell things, you'll feel things. there's a relational aspect to that. So you're kind of recognizing that all of that's going on and it's going to happen mm-hmm. anyway.
Yes.
You don't necessarily need to intellectualize about it or theorize mm-hmm. about it. You might do maybe at some other time, but ultimately when you're going with it, you just dive in.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's about looking for feedback all the time. So I might have observed someone else do it. I think, right, I'm going to give that a go. So then I'll think, well, what did they do? What were the bits that I really noticed? And I'll start exploring it. And then I'll be looking for the response with the client. Mm. Are they responding the way I expect? Is something different happening? Did their eye just twitch in a funny way? Did they have a little smile in their mouth? Has their complexion changed? What's taking place? It's that real awareness. And then you just adapt. But it will also be based on prior knowledge. Because I think you're like me. We go on a lot of training courses and look at lots of different therapeutic processes and ways they work. So I think at that unconscious level, you start to pick up on language patterns, body language, the way people interact with the world.
Well, it's the age-old thing for me of that balance between theory and practice. There was something I heard yesterday. It was on a podcast, and it was I'll have to think about it and try and remember it or find it later. But it was to do with theory and practice, and this mm-hmm. idea that, you know, in theory, you, what is it? In theory, it always works in practice. Something like, I'll look it up afterwards. But the point here is about balancing theory and practice mm-hmm. for me. You know, how much theory do you need to be effective?
Yeah.
How much practice do you need to be effective? What then is effective? Mm-hmm. How do we acquire new skills? How do we get to a place that we want to be? And what parts of us that are very intellectual, that, you know, require you know, some kind of mathematical reasoning yeah. or logic or some way of describing what we do?
Yeah.
How much of that is important? How much of that is needed? Mm-hmm. And actually, how much is all the stuff that we don't talk about? You know, when you were talking earlier on, and you know, we would, and me just asking you about acquiring skill, I was thinking of David Beckham, actually, uh-huh. because one of the things that I end up doing a lot is working in a number of different environments with okay. different groups. So some of the work I do is in the automotive industry. Mm-hmm. And that's a very different environment to a university, for example.
Yes.
So within a university setting, it's very easy to get lots of women along uh-huh. to anything to do with well-being. Not so easy to get men along no. to anything to do with well-being. Whereas when I'm in the automotive industry, actually it's predominantly men anyway that we're working with. Likewise, there's a readiness to talk about the theory, to yeah. talk about why this might be, mm-hmm. to talk about the kind of stories that underpin anything that we're talking about within, a university setting. Whereas in an automotive setting, actually it's very practical.
Yeah.
And so kind of working this out, this balance mm-hmm. that's needed in these different settings, I think is, you know, half the issue, really.
Yeah, and
it, but it's one of the things that I wrestle with all the time.
Uh-huh.
You know, am I overthinking something?
Yeah.
You know, what's going on right now? Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose it's that those practitioner skills, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
You know, what's going on right now that is supporting the relational field?
Yeah.
What's going on that might not be quite so helpful?
Yeah.
You know, we can talk about that. What's helpful and what's hindering? Mm. And asking that kind of question around then the tendency to theorize or the tendency towards practice is, I think it's a bit of an art.
It is. That's and it. I think a lot of that comes down to there's so much more going on, like you said, than it is just presenting, because people have got beliefs about themselves, beliefs about the world, the identity that they assume within different contexts. All of that plays a massive part, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And on what level do you manifest a belief?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I could walk in the room now and there'll be all sorts of things mm-hmm. about the way that I walk, where I look, what I'm wearing as I come in, that will be representations. You know, you'll be able to tell all sorts of things yeah. about beliefs that I have.
Mm-hmm.
From what I'm doing, and there's nothing Absolutely. That's being said at all.
No.
And then we get into a conversation, and suddenly there are all these other ways in which mm-hmm. the beliefs start to be manifest.
Yeah.
So yes, yeah.
It's interesting.
All those different layers to take on board at any time, in all interactions.
Yes.
And because if we're thinking about what are interesting questions, I really like questions around boundaries.
Uh-huh.
So, how can we distinguish one thing from another?
Yeah.
And within an awful lot of life, it's relatively easy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think you and I are really good at telling the difference between cups and chairs.
Yes.
we'd probably be able to go, oh, yes, that's definitely a chair.
Yeah.
That's definitely a cup. But there are all sorts of things in life where actually it then starts to become a little bit more difficult to draw those distinctions. Mm-hmm. And one of them might be, what's therapy and what's not therapy?
Yes.
There are certain edge cases where you go, well, that's really easy.
Mm-hmm.
I'd go along to that thing that's got relate written on the outside of it, and I go through the door and you take me into a room and we close that door. No one else comes in and I'm sat there with someone and we're both in chairs and we're talking and they're filling out something. You've got the trappings of therapy.
Yes.
But there are all sorts of experiences we have that are truly therapeutic.
Mm-hmm.
There is some kind of significant change in our mind, body, feelings, beliefs, whatever. And actually, it doesn't fit any of that criteria.
Yeah.
We weren't in, we were out on the common kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'm curious about that. What's therapy and what's not therapy?
And I think that's so individualized, isn't it? It's situation, context dependent, and also on the person. But I know when a lot of people come to work with me, they've had, like say, traditional-based therapies where it's talking therapies. And so I'll give them a little overview of how I work. But after the first session, the number one thing that people say, I have phenomenal results. It creates a massive shift in people. They're like, wow, that was weird. And that's the most common thing I hear. And then they'll say, a really good weird. Because I don't think it meets the expectations of what they think it's going to be. It's something completely different. But that giving that space to allow them to explore it in whatever way it needs to be explored completely frees them up to make the changes. But like you say, therapy can be so broad in how it's delivered. And what is therapeutic?
But there's something really interesting there, because weird is a word that I hear a lot.
Yes.
And is that okay? That was really, that was really weird. Is it supposed to be weird?
Yes.
And very often I'll find myself saying, if we're getting into weird territory, that's usually a really good sign.
Yeah.
The weirder it is, probably, the more interesting the territory that we're getting into. Yeah, exactly. There's something interesting for me there then,
mm-hmm.
about how expectations around therapeutic work are set,
mm-hmm.
how we acquire those expectations, how we acquire the beliefs around that. Because if you've got someone who's coming in and they're saying, this is really weird, it's not what I expect, what are they expecting?
Yeah.
And where do those expectations come from?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the things that I also am quite challenged by in the work that I do. Managing expectations.
Mm-hmm.
So being able to communicate effectively, particularly when we do things that are so different to what you do down the pub.
Yes.
There are, ways of talking,
mm-hmm.
Therapeutic ways of talking that are more like what you might do down the pub, because there's talking going on and
mm-hmm.
we're very chatty usually down pubs. But there are lots of other things that we do that are just not like that at all.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about how we bridge those expectation gaps.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we can, there's a way that I think we can reduce the amount of time sometimes
yes.
we spend helping individuals to acclimatize
mm-hmm.
to ways of looking after themselves or
yep.
ways of going through a process of mm-hmm. change. Because I think sometimes there is quite a lot of acclimatizing. You and I have spoken before about the ways in which we will speak about health, well-being, therapy,
mm-hmm.
and how we'll communicate about these quite often are very ineffable concepts and really difficult to pin down ideas, but trying to find simple and ready ways of talking what is health or what is success in a context of mm-hmm. a therapeutic encounter, how does hypnotherapy work?
Yeah.
We're trying to find these ways of talking about it that will enable clients to understand where they're at, where they're going, where they've been. And so I do find that a challenge. And so this idea about boundary, you know, what is one thing and what is not? Mm. You know, what is therapy? What isn't it? Yeah. What is okay? What is not?
Uh-huh.
What is stressful? You know, stress is an interesting one, isn't
it? Yes, fascinating.
You know, I spend a lot of time working on this distinction between, because, here's something to test you out on then. I want to check this with you. Yeah. Is there such a thing as good stress in your opinion?
In my opinion, for me personally, sometimes yes.
Wrong.
Because sometimes it can be a real good motivator for me to get things done. I quite like working under pressure, but I don't necessarily identify it as being stress. It probably comes down to what I would label it as. But sometimes having that slight raised elevations in my body of a sense of urgency, I suppose it gives me, which I thrive on. If I had that all the time, it wouldn't do me any good. It would probably burn me out. But I quite like the feeling sometimes of that change of, because it feels, I think the difference is, it feels quite exciting for me. And I sort of get tingly in my body. I get energized.
I
get very, very enthusiastic. And this is why, I suppose, for me, I am always running several courses at once. I'm always seeing lots of clients a week. I'm always like, I want to do a PhD. I want to do this. I want to create this. Because I think I thrive on an element of good stress. So for me, yes, but perhaps for some other people, not.
Oh, that's great. And that's, I'm glad that you found that kind of font of fuel to go off and do the things that you want to do.
Mm.
And what's interesting to me is, you know, you talk about the feelings that you have and being comfortable with those feelings.
Yes.
And, you know, we've talked before about the stress response, response and the relaxation response.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm hearing lots of things about the stress response there, which is a psychophysiological response to an environmental problem, threat, challenge, whatever. And so, you know, you've got this way that the body and mind change in response to something that needs to be solved, something that needs to be dealt with. And you had a very positive spin on that, though.
Yeah.
Because you even went, you know, to... Actually, maybe it's not stress. Maybe it's just pressure that I'm talking about here. But there's something really...
I suppose there's a difference between stress and overwhelm for me.
Ah.
So I know that some stress, actually, I don't mind. I'm okay. If it becomes too much in too many areas, then it maybe tips into overwhelm. And then that stops the flow of thoughts.
Mm.
But when I've got a bit of stress, it allows me to be very creative and very driven.
Mm.
Too much makes me go, this is a bit too much. So I think maybe that's where I would get a lot of clients when they've got to that point. Where it's, I'm in overwhelm, I'm in panic, I'm in this constant stress response that is now starting to be detrimental to my life.
Yeah. And that gets to it, really. Because I'd end up in conversations that are quite confusing. This is, we're all right, we're doing all right at the moment. I'm not confused. I don't think I'm feeling confused. You can tell me whether I am. But end up in conversations that feel confusing because on the one hand, there is someone who is using the word stress and talking about it very positively.
Mm-hmm.
And they're talking about what excites them. They're talking about what motivates them. They're talking about coming up with new ideas. So they're, you know, very often they're talking about creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And then they use the word stress. And then they're talking about feeling overwhelmed, having ways that their thinking is changing and being quite restrictive.
Mm-hmm.
And actually their, you know, whole demeanor changes.
Yeah.
You can see that change in the way that the body is relating to those thoughts then. And so there is this weird kind of contradiction in what we mean by stress.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that if we just put the word response on the end, I think something else happens. So if you talk about a stress response, you can just say there is a physiological response to threat or problem.
Yeah. It's situational rather than an ongoing thing.
And it is situational, but it's something about, you know, biophysical processes.
Mm-hmm.
But if we talk about feeling stressed, actually, generally speaking, most people add kind of negative connotations to that. Yeah. Feeling stress is not the same as having a stress response. Mm-hmm. You could say feeling a stress response, okay, you could, you know, start to confuse it there. And that, and that's why I think it can be really helpful to really draw a distinction between them.
Yep.
And so personally, I don't say that there is such a good thing. Such a thing as good stress. Yeah. Stress, as in feeling stress, yeah, is actually an expression of what isn't working for us, the, yes, stuff that's unhelpful. Mm-hmm. There's a good thing, which is a stress response, but there's a good thing that's a relaxation response. You've got, yeah, both of those. So you've got biophysical responses. Mm-hmm. And they're normal.
Yeah.
They're about, you know, mobilizing and making things happen in the world. Mm-hmm. And they're okay. And as you say, we can learn to be more or less comfortable with them.
Yeah.
You know, that often people talk about how close kind of fear and excitement are, mm-hmm, physiologically. Yeah. I remember hearing that was something that made me first kind of switch on to Sam Harris and the, you know, mm-hmm, stuff that he talks about, because he was talking about how close physiologically those things can be.
Yeah.
But actually, the way that we frame them, the way that we think about them, the thoughts that arise in response to those feelings can be quite different. Well, they are quite different.
It's the stories we tell ourselves.
It's the stories we tell ourselves, absolutely. And so, yeah, there's something within that that I think is, it gets back to this idea about setting expectations, mm-hmm, and enabling individuals to navigate life. And sometimes it is a little bit about clearing out.
Yes.
You know, you were talking before about someone saying, I really want you to help me, you know, kind of clean my house more effectively or whatever, or be more okay with cleaning the house. Yes, I like the idea of that. Clearing out our lives so that we're just feeling better about our lives. And one of them for me is clearing up sometimes the way that we talk about stuff. So I'm an advocate of drawing a distinction between stress and a stress response. And a stress response is great.
Yes.
Stress, no one wants stress.
Yes, and I agree with that, yeah.
You don't want to feel bad. Why would you want to? You might do, and it is a normal part of life, absolutely. I'm not suggesting we all, you know, we can go through feeling blissful all the time.
Feelings and thoughts are messages, aren't they? So if we're feeling an unhelpful thought pattern, a mindset, we're dealing with difficult situations in our lives, our body's in a mind saying, you need to change something. Mm. So they are useful. They're learning tools. Any reaction that we get in our body is a learning tool. We just need to learn how to interpret it.
Yes. Yeah.
And we're not taught how to do that.
No. And so, you know, we've been talking about a number of models, haven't we? And have you come across compassion-focused therapy?
Not a lot of it.
There's just a really nice model within that, okay, that talks about these different circuits that we have.
Right.
And you've got your drive circuit, uh-huh, which is the one which is about acquiring, which is the one that, you know, has adrenaline associated with it, but it also, mm-hmm, has dopamine associated with it. So again, okay, it kind of maps on to some of the kind of neurophysiology, mm-hmm, and psychoneuroendocrinology that, you know, became very popular a few years ago, didn't it? But the point is there are a number of different physical markers, biological, mm-hmm, markers that you can put onto that circuit. But it is that one that is about, you know, making things happen. It's about acquiring status. It's about gathering resources, that kind of thing. And, mm-hmm, it's a useful circuit. Yeah. We have another circuit, which is our stress circuit, which is about dealing with threats. And it was, mm-hmm, you know, so that's got fear and that's got the stress hormones that are associated with it, you know, strongly kind of cortisol as being a big one there, mm-hmm, but adrenaline and again, it is about just protecting us and, yeah, making sure that, you know, we look after ourselves and we avoid threats and we fight off, mm-hmm, you know, predators and that, yeah, kind of thing. And actually, our modern society is, those two are really connected,
yes,
and are, you know, very prevalent. Mm-hmm. They are stimulated quite considerably by our ways of living, by the pressures that, it is the stories that we tell ourselves about, mm-hmm, you know, what's important in modern life. But there is this other circuit, which is the nurture circuit. Yeah. And actually, that's really important.
It's really important and very often, yeah, neglected.
Very often neglected. And you've got your, you know, you've got your dopamine, you've got your oxytocin, you've got your serotonin, you've got these, again, these different hormonal markers that you can attach to it. But you've also got these behaviours that go with it. You know, you've got these ones of making eye contact. You've got these ones of physical touch, you've got these ones of presence, mm-hmm. you've got these ones of experiencing some of the more positive, what yeah. we might call positive emotions. Mm-hmm. And you can do some mapping using this, I find. Yeah. And I find that there are lots of clients that I've had that have found this quite useful because it speaks to different important drives that we have.
Yeah.
You know, we have a drive to acquire. Mm-hmm. We have a drive to achieve. We have a drive to protect ourselves and to defend ourselves. But we also have a drive to be well, to rest, mm-hmm. to recuperate. And actually, is there a sense of balance yeah. between these? Do we have one that we have more of a tendency mm-hmm. towards? Do we find that there are ones, you know, one of those circuits or more than one of those circuits that actually feel like they're problematic for
yes.
us? So yeah, I find that a quite nice model to explore.
That one.
Yeah.
And I think I'm going to look at that for myself. Just because I think sometimes the nurture side is what I end up lacking because I get so into being busy and what I'm doing and I really enjoy that. I do think I probably need more nurture and more self-compassion sometimes, and that's something I've been practicing incorporating into my life more and more of late. So thank you for highlighting that.
You're very welcome. Do you know another one that I use, uh-huh. and I was thinking about it this morning actually, is the concept of ikigai. Mm-hmm. That actually has been such a helpful framework for me. So this idea of, you know, what you're good at, mm-hmm. what you enjoy, what makes a contribution, but also what sustains you.
Yeah.
And moving beyond that way that you'll often find it on, if you Google it on the internet, you know, it talks about what your career needs to be in terms of what sustains you. I mean, in a broader sense,
yeah.
what sustains you. Mm-hmm. So what sustains others, what sustains you, what do you enjoy, what you're good at. These are great filters to
Absolutely.
Put our lives through at any time, aren't they?
Yep.
We can ask that question. Because I find myself now more often, you know, not quite on necessarily a weekly basis, but certainly very regularly going, mm-hmm. hang on a minute. Do I have a sense of my ikigai balance? You know, am I doing a lot for others and yeah. not enough for me? Am I doing too much for me?
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes I notice that in a sense of, am I withdrawing quite a lot and going mm-hmm. into my little, you know, I'm reading a lot and I'm going off for my solitary walks kind of thing. Or is there a sense that I'm balanced around that? And I don't mean by balance we do the same amount of things in each, but just that sense of it feels like there's an equilibrium about it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's another one that I really use as well.
I like that. And I think when you are a therapeutic practitioner, you end up going to these models a lot and you're doing a lot of self-reflection all the time. I know I do, because, well, we do it with our clients, but it becomes a way of life, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. And yeah. I think that's important.
Yeah.
And I wish everyone could have that because it makes life really interesting and it's really beneficial.
Do you know, I don't know if it ended up being helpful, but I remember years ago, and it was when I, very early in craniosacral practice, mm-hmm. I got invited by the local or regional branch of the British Dental Association to come along and talk about craniosacral therapy. Because there was a dentist that had set up fairly recently. He'd been within the forces and had come into kind of more general dental practice. And he was very proactive, lovely guy. We got chatting about all sorts of things. And he was just interested in other approaches that might relate to dental health. And he'd heard that there were connections between cranial osteopathy, cranial psychotherapy, dental work. And he wondered what my perspective on that was and if I could come in and talk to the dentist.
Yeah.
So I did.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how successful I was at communicating what it was that I did. But, you know, one of the metaphors I used was, it relates to very much what you were just saying about there are ways that we work with individuals and we introduce mm-hmm. practices, strategies, ways of being, ways of talking to ourselves, ways of reflecting, ways of just being aware. And we practice those ourselves.
Yeah.
And actually, unless we do practice them ourselves, how well can we know those tools?
Yep.
And how well can we advocate for those mm-hmm. tools? You know, would I go and get advice from a plumber who I can see that there's leaks all over the house kind of thing. And I'm going, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. And so the metaphor I used with them was, you know, I I work with people, and it's almost like I've got this backpack.
Yep.
And actually, it's a load of stuff that I put in this backpack that I found as being really useful tools.
Mm-hmm.
And I carry this backpack as we then explore a terrain that's their terrain.
Yeah.
And I also brought in that idea of, you know, emotions are like fog. You can't go over them. You can't go under them. You can't go around them. You've got to go through them, kind of thing. And I would say that health challenges are like that.
Mm-hmm.
They're like fog. And I like to think that I've been through quite a lot of fog.
Yeah.
I've found some really good ways of navigating that fog.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can share those with others. Hopefully some of that will be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that are and seem to be helpful over time, I keep in the backpack.
Yeah.
The ones that aren't, I kind of pop into a trunk that I might go back to at some other time, but I leave that at home.
Yes.
But ultimately, that's what I end up doing. Now, how that went down with a bunch of dentists, I've got no idea. I think you can deal with them. A bit woo, a bit wacky there. But that actually still, you know, this is, how many years now? Must be 17 years later.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, that's a reasonable way of me talking about what I do.
I think that's great, because I think you're a bit like me. We do a lot, and it's quite hard to sum up briefly to other people what it is we do, because we've got so many other things that we can draw upon at different times.
Yeah.
Something that I think some listeners might be intrigued about is, what actually is cranial sacral therapy? Sorry, I know that's probably a massive question itself, because I don't know a lot.
That's a good question.
Because I know lots of people that I've known over the years. I'm quite into the wellbeing circuits. I've got lots of friends who are into wellbeing. And some of them said, oh, do you know what? I've had this and it's been amazing. And I've said, oh, that's great. But I've sort of brushed over them. Well, what specifically happens? So I'd quite like to know, please.
Well, that's two different questions. Yes. And I like the second question more. Okay. What
we'll
happens?
Do that one, then.
Yeah, can we do that one first? What happens? Okay, craniosacral therapy.
Yeah.
There is a bit of history. Because sometimes it can be helpful to know where something comes from.
Mm-hmm.
That said, though, I think there are elements of where it comes from that I think can be slightly misleading.
Okay.
Craniosacral therapy grew out of osteopathy, really.
Okay.
And grew out of cranial osteopathy, or osteopathy in the cranial field.
Mm-hmm.
So you had a load of osteopaths, particularly over in the States initially, that started to work in more and more subtle ways. And I mean, there are some really interesting stories from people like, there was a guy called William Garner Sutherland,
mm-hmm.
who had trained with the original kind of Andrew Taylor Still, the father of osteopathy. Mm. And he developed this, Sutherland developed this idea of osteopathy in the cranial field, which was a really much more subtle way, a much more gentle way of working with health within mm-hmm. the individual. And related to what he considered to be subtle movements that would go on within, particularly within cranial bones and the relationship between the cranial bones and the spine.
Absolutely.
And the reciprocal tension membrane system, it can
okay.
often be referred to, which is basically a connection of, you know, the bones in the head, the bones in the spine, lots of tenderness connections, muscular connections, mm-hmm. the fascial connections. So, you know, that connective tissue we have, that fascia, all of those connections, there's a kind of way that the body seems to record
mm-hmm.
its experiences within that system. And you can work with that system to help release
mm-hmm.
kind of traumas that can get locked in.
Yeah.
So he started developing that. Lots of osteopaths developed all that kind of thing, and it spread.
Mm-hmm.
And in the kind of 80s, 90s, you started to see cranial osteopaths training individuals in something called craniosacral therapy. In other words, recognizing you didn't have to be an osteopath mm-hmm. to engage in some of the practices that they engaged in. So there you go.
Yeah.
That's a bit of where it comes mm-hmm. from. What is it, though? Okay, so what happens? So usually it's something mm-hmm. where you will have an individual practitioner
yeah.
working with an individual client. You can get more than one practitioner mm-hmm. working with a client. It's touch-based,
yeah.
generally speaking, although there's a current controversy about how much is relational and how much is intentional, and uh-huh. so how much actual touch is required. But from my own perspective, it's touch-based.
Yeah.
And you'll do it fully clothed. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are times when sometimes you might work, you know, directly with skin. 99.9% of my practice is people lay down, yeah, fully clothed on a couch, mm-hmm, you know, a massage couch, and we relate to stillness.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think that's one way of putting it. So you could say it's a kind of touch-based mindfulness.
Okay.
Because there's something about awareness that comes into this, mm-hmm, something about perception, perceptual fields. There's something that's very relational about it. It is a very gentle practice. You know, there's not big manipulations. It's about listening with your hands, mm-hmm, people often say. So what will it feel like to have it? Well, you know, you'll do a bit of talking with a therapist.
Yeah.
You'll get a sense of, you know, or they'll probably invite you to explore, mm-hmm, you know, where you've come from, you know, what your health history is.
Yeah.
You know, the usual kind of case, mm-hmm, history kind of taking. But get a sense of where you feel you are and where you feel you want to go. And then you'll lay down, mm-hmm, and you might do a bit of talking, but it's really about inviting you to still and to notice what happens, yeah, when you invite that kind of stilling. And then the therapist, you know, I will put my hands on people and I'll listen to their... We often use the word system because we haven't got a better word, yes, for it, really. So I'll listen to their system. In other words, I'll relate to them in a way that... Actually, here's a way of thinking about,
okay,
it. Another model that I find helpful is thinking about as having three bodies.
Uh-huh.
Yeah? So we've got a physical body.
Yeah.
That's an easy one. And, you know, the extent of the physical body is pretty much an inch out from the physical body.
Yeah.
You can feel heat from, uh-huh, something that's quite close to you. But ultimately, the physical body is the physical body. And the physical body is quite slow.
Yeah.
You know, changes in it are generally quite slow.
Yeah.
Particularly if it becomes damaged, quite significantly damaged. You know, muscles can take weeks, months, mm-hmm, to heal when they've been damaged,
yep,
that kind of thing. You know, organs, again, can take a, mm-hmm, long time to heal from trauma.
Yep.
So the physical body has generally slower processes, mm-hmm, involved in it. We also have an emotional body.
Yeah.
And that's a bit bigger.
Uh-huh.
And we really kind of connect emotional bodies,
yes,
where, you know, across, you know, this kind of distance, room kind of distance.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's a reason why rooms are roughly the kind of size that rooms are.
Yeah.
When you get rooms that are much bigger, they're a bit useless because we just can't relate emotionally,
yeah,
is my theory on that. Suddenly come up with that one. But no, you know, emotional bodies are that little bit, mm-hmm, wider. And emotional tones and moods are a little bit faster than the kind of physical stuff.
Yeah.
They can snap into being, and they can also snap out. But they can last, you know, minutes, hours sometimes. For them to last longer than that, you've got to have the mental body involved. And the, mm-hmm, mental body is as big as the universe. The mental body,
that,
is just huge. Because I can imagine black holes, you know, 13 billion light years away,
uh-huh,
but I can also think about the pink unicorn that is not on your shoulder right now, but I'm imagining it, and actually it's strutting its stuff, it's waving its tail around. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
So there's this amazing thing that the mental body can do, mm-hmm, and they all interact.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things about craniosacral therapy, or CST,
mm-hmm,
I call it CST because craniosacral therapy doesn't mean anything more than CST. CST is a way of relating to those bodies.
Brilliant.
It recognizes that all of us express our being, our health, through those bodies.
Yeah.
So there'll be ways that our physical body, so touching the physical body, being in touch with the physical, mm, body, and how it relates to stilling is really important when it comes to supporting through a healing process.
Yeah.
But likewise, the emotional body is important as well.
Mm-hmm.
So me being, you know, learning to be aware and continually learning to be aware of my own emotions, mm-hmm, and my own emotional landscape, so that I can relate emotionally to another, is really part of it. But likewise, the mental body, being able to put it into a narrative, tell a story, explain something, also recognize those ways that the mental body can trigger reactions,
yep,
and responses from the physical. And that's the thing, the physical and the emotional bodies are very reactive.
Mm-hmm.
And the mental body kind of less so, unless you've got some kind of loop that's going on.
Yeah.
So, you know, earlier on you were talking about those feelings in your body that you could either consider to be exciting and be okay with or not.
Uh-huh.
We can be aware of, you know, physical feelings we have. And actually, you know, we know that from people that we were probably from our own lives as well. Suddenly all these anxious thoughts, you know, get triggered off. Oh, what does this mean? Mm-hmm. My heart started doing that kind of thing. There's that way that those bodies can interact. So that's one aspect of CST. I think stillness invites us to really pay attention and to really notice.
Mm-hmm.
And that relationship between stillness and motion. So there's, you know, recognizing where there is stillness, where there is movement, is a kind of crucial way of tuning into how health expresses.
Mm-hmm.
You get a lot of CST practitioners talking about, you know, expression of health in the system.
Yeah.
And it's funny, when I first started working, I didn't use the word energy.
Uh-huh.
And partly, you know, that's from my own kind of scientific background training kind of thing. And energy has very specific definitions.
Yeah.
And it's a bit woo, bit way if we start talking about energy, I thought. But actually, I find it a really useful term.
Yeah.
You know, there's an energy of the conversation we're having. Mm-hmm. There's an energy that I'm feeling now. And it's a way of us talking about, referring to that which makes things happen.
Yeah.
How stuff happens. Mm-hmm. So we talk about energy in a system, energy in a person. You know, okay, you may say that there's quite poetic language involved in that, but that then links to, and this is very much, I think, CST, the kind of art of therapeutic practice.
Yeah.
So the heart that goes into that,
mm-hmm.
the humanity that goes into that, the just relating to another and holding a space for another.
Yeah.
There are lots of practices within CST that I think are really helpful for making that happen. So I have no idea if that makes any sense to either you or any of your listeners, but that's how I'd start to talk about what CST is. You know, usually it's something between 45 minutes and an hour and a mm-hmm. half that we'll spend getting you to lie down and explore. And there's a bit, you know, a session has the, you know, the beginning, the middle and the end. So there's a way that we seek some kind of new equilibrium
mm-hmm.
to be reached by the end of the session, so you can go off into the rest of your life again.
Brilliant.
You know, the bit of reflection, you know, there's always space for that. But I have clients that don't say anything. And I have clients that talk continually. You know, I have clients that come along and say, I know what I want, do that right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I have those that go, I have no idea what I want. I just need something. You know, so it can be quite an open,
uh-huh.
yeah, it can be quite an open space that can be held through, I think, craniosacral practice.
I think I'm just going to have to come at some point just for the experience of it.
but it's like that, isn't it? We have to experience these things.
Yes. Yeah.
And that was that, I'm going to have to look it up, that thing that I wanted to find for you earlier on about theory and practice, because what it was encapsulating was, we don't really know something until we do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I get this a lot with working with anyone who's interested in just improving their well-being.
Yeah.
And you know, this is one of the things about the mental body. The mental, you know, our mental selves can imagine, oh, yes, for tea, I'm going to have that really healthy salad. And I can think of that right now. But now I've thought of it, so I can let that go and I'll just have my piece of cake.
Yeah.
You know, there is that way that you can think
mm-hmm.
of something and actually not experience the benefits of that thing. Because of course you can't, because you're just thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And very often then we'll dismiss things for that reason.
Yeah.
You know, we'll think, oh, you know, should I meditate now? Would that be a good thing to do? Yeah, but thinking about meditation isn't making me feel any better. So no, it's probably not going to make me feel any better. It's not going to do anything for me. Going for a run.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can think about going for a run. Oh, actually, it just feels tiring. I feel tired even thinking about it. But we know that, you know, when we do more exercise, we know that when we do engage in practices that enable mm-hmm. us to find a balance between the stress response and relaxation response, so meditation being one of those, mm-hmm. we know that it does make a difference to individuals and group
Absolutely.
Experience of health.
Mm-hmm.
But our minds don't know that. And that's the thing, the mind and body has to experience it and do it
yeah.
for us really to go, oh, do you know, I'm so glad I did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, I love that.
So come along and do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I'm going to. We're going to have to come to an end in a minute because we've talked a lot, but I feel like we could talk for hours and hours more.
Yeah.
But we need to be aware of our listeners. So before you go, a couple of things is, if anybody wants to work with you, where would they find you?
They would find me online if you look for embodymind, all one word, .co.uk, then you will find me. That's my website, www.embodymind.co.uk.
Excellent.
And I'm based in central Lincoln at the Terrace. Wonderful cafe downstairs, Cafe Portico. I work in there. I've been there since 2010.
Wow.
So, yeah, I feel quite established there.
Great. That's brilliant. And the last thing I'd like to ask is, have you got any final parting words of wisdom or guidance that you could give to our audience today? Just to put you on the spot there.
I wouldn't presume to know what would be good wisdom or guidance. But I think, you know, what I would say is reflective practice, development of self-awareness and awareness of others. You can't go wrong.
Yeah.
If you do that, you know, being open to recognizing that sometimes how we think about something is 99% of how something is.
Yep.
So if we reflect upon that and we're open to change that, to listen to ourselves, to listen to others, and to be changed by others, and, you know, to have that interest in helping others to change, yeah, I don't think we can go far.
Amazing. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you very much. It's been a great, great conversation.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Take care, and I shall speak to you again soon. Bye-bye for now. If you enjoyed this podcast, please make sure you subscribe. If you would like to find out more about the therapies that we provide and the training we offer, please visit our website, www.tranquil-awakenings.co.uk. You can also find us on social media.